Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
And good afternoon, everybody. Happy Tuesday, and welcome to another day on another hour of Cresta in the Afternoon. Al's off the mic today, but we do have other great things to talk about. How do American universities teach American history? As we talked about a little bit in the last hour, understanding America's past and the uniqueness of the American experience in history is crucial to understanding America's present and future. Unfortunately, most American students lack any kind of basic proficiency in understanding their own history. A new report from Arizona State's Center for American Institutions helps us quantify that problem, and Dr. Donald Critchlow will join us. He is the director of the Center for American Institutions at Arizona State, is also a Katz and Family professor there, and is the author of several books, including Intended Consequences, Birth Control, Abortion in the Federal Government, Revolutionary Monsters, Five Men Who Turned Liberation into Tyranny, and In Defense of Populism, Protest in American Democracy. Dr. Critchlow has joined us many times over the years. He's also a listener. It's always fun to have a guest who also just enjoys listening to the program on their own. And he is our guest in the first segment of this hour. Later on in this hour, another very important question. How do we know that we can trust the Gospels? As a Christian, you're often asked for the sources of one of our beliefs, and we'll point to a passage from one of the Gospels or from somewhere else in the New Testament. How do we know that the Gospels are a reliable source? Lydia McGrew joins us with simple yet concrete answers to the age-old question, why should I believe what the Bible says about the life and teachings of Jesus? Dr. McGrew is the author, again, of the book Testimonies to the Truth, Why You Can Trust the Gospels, widely published analytical philosopher, author, and wife of a philosopher, Timothy McGrew. She received her PhD in English from Vanderbilt University and has published extensively in the theory of knowledge, specializing in formal epistemology and its application to the evaluation of testimony and the philosophy of religion. She defends the reliability of the Gospels and the Book of Acts in her outstanding book, Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospel and Acts, as well as her other book, The Mirror or the Mask, Liberating the Gospels from Literary Devices. You can learn more about her work at lydiamcgrew.com, and we'll talk to her and to Dr. Don Critchlow after this news break with Steve Clark.
Thanks, Brian. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, April 16th. It's the Feast of St. Bernadette. Today's news brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at avemariafunds.com. New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan was in Jerusalem during Saturday's drone and missile attack by Iran. Dolan took shelter at the Notre Dame of Jerusalem Center, an organization that offers hospitality to pilgrims visiting the Holy Land. In a video posted to X on Sunday, Dolan thanked listeners for their prayers and support. With the support of the U.S. and other allies, Israel intercepted 99% of the hundreds of airstrikes. Israel is deciding the best way to respond to the attack. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called his war cabinet for a second time in less than 24 hours. Responding would go against President Biden's request for the country to stand down. Google is facing protests from some of its workers over its contract to provide cloud services to Israel. A group of employees began a sit-in in the workspace of Google Cloud CEO at the company's San Francisco area offices. They said they would not leave until Google met its demands to pull out of the contract. A similar demonstration also took place at the Google offices in New York City. Six jurors have been chosen for the Donald Trump New York City trial. The process is at the halfway mark, and the jury selection process will continue until a panel of 12 New Yorkers and six alternates have been selected. The former president is accused of falsifying business records in order to cover up payments made to an adult film star just prior to the 2016 election. And a Supreme Court case could squash felony charges against the January 6 rioters and former President Trump. The justices are hearing an appeal brought by a former police officer who is seeking to dismiss a charge accusing him trying to overturn the 2020 election. The officer argues the obstruction law only applies to document shredding. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Understanding America's past and the uniqueness of the American experience, our history, is crucial to understanding our future. Unfortunately, most American students seem to lack basic proficiency in understanding their own history. There's a new report from Arizona State Center for American Institutions that looks very seriously at this problem and quantifies it. Dr. Donald Critchlow will join us. He's the Katz and Family Professor at Arizona State, where he directs the Center for American Institutions. He's joined us in the past on topics of his books, including Intended Consequences, Birth Control, Abortion, the Federal Government, and Modern America, and Revolutionary Monsters, Five Men Who Turned Liberation into Tyranny. Dr. Critchlow, a pleasure to have you back with me. Thanks.
Well, it's all my pleasure to be honored again with appearing on your show, and I'm a great fan of your program and often listen to it on my way home from work. So thank you very much.
Well, let's talk about why this is important. Why is civic education so important for our republic?
Well, I think as you said in your introduction, young Americans need to understand the not only the travails that we've experienced as a nation in fulfilling our vision as a constitutional republic, but it's also important for just understanding their responsibility as citizens when they go to the voting booth. What we found in this year-long study looking at syllabi across the country, what's occurring in introductory courses, is that students are basically being taught what I would consider a political agenda in which America is viewed as having made no progress at all on the advancement of minority groups, especially black civil rights, voting rights, but also the advancement of women. And I think what was particularly shocking is not only what this agenda was including, but what was also being excluded, just basic facts or information about the Civil War, World War One, World War Two, the Cold War, and all of those basic topics that informed citizen needs to know.
Is this a result of the faculty themselves, or are they beholden to larger institutions or departments that are offering curricula?
Well, I think it's faculty themselves that are bringing in a political agenda.
Okay.
We now have in this country 1.5 million instructors in higher education. And we know from survey after survey that 70% consider themselves left or left-wing. Unfortunately, their politics is being brought into the classroom. So the teaching of American history has become part of a political agenda. And my own feeling, and I think most of your listeners would agree with this, that one's personal political view shouldn't be introduced into the classroom. There should be the pursuit of objectivity, but also a belief that the one's mission in the classroom is not only to teach basic information, but also to create an informed citizenry that's able to think critically about the past, about America's past, and what its future is going to be.
I'm curious, America has had a unique experience, and the role of religion in American history is quite significant. Do they do these instructors deal even-handedly with the role of religion in our founding documents, the abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, the civil rights movement?
Well, that, it's not what we discovered in the, in our year-long study in which we looked at 75 syllabi being taught in our universities, private and public, and across the country, is that religion was not even discussed. And if you don't understand the importance of religion, whatever your own religious beliefs are, you cannot understand, as you just said, the abolitionist movement, which was driven by a Christian impulse, women's suffrage, the temperance movement, or Martin Luther King's civil rights movement. Yeah. In fact, Martin Luther, none of these topics were discussed at all in the 75 syllabi that we looked at. And I might add to that, in that we were able to only find 75 syllabi that were public. I mean, it's if history departments don't want the public to know what's being taught to our students.
That's amazing to me. So, do the curricula that you looked at, the syllabi that you looked at, do they emphasize, you know, things like white supremacy or diversity or equity?
Yeah, of course, there is a great deal of emphasis on equity, how it's not been fulfilled. There was absolutely no discussion of Marx having brought prosperity to people and opportunities to people. The Industrial Revolution was taught only in a few courses as basically one of worker oppression. And I think one of the most astounding things we found is that the courses all taught basically no progress has been made, and that America from its very inception was a nation in decline.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing in the classroom in our as we concluded, and the National Commissioners, Scott Walker, former governor of Wisconsin, Newt Gingrich, and former governor of Oklahoma, concluded that we're seeing propaganda and not education. It's miseducation of our youth. And I think that explains much of the problem that we're seeing among our youth today, of not only not being informed, but also, you know, kind of their left-wing sentiment that's found among large numbers of young voters, especially those going to colleges.
You know, in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, a great nation did what most great nations don't do. It basically repented of what had been a major theme in the South, the theme of separate but equal. That's something to be celebrated. Not giving credit where credit is due really does irk me. And did they celebrate America's capacity for change in this way?
Well, of course not. In fact, I mean, let's be more precise. Some of the courses, you know, had a theme of let me backtrack and say that all of the courses had a theme of the oppressed and the oppressor.
Yeah.
And one of uniformity throughout American history. But we also have professors taking as a theme for their course incarceration. So that is that we're, you know, this is the incarcerated minority, how they fully develop that in the classroom in their lectures wasn't apparent from the syllabi, but that was the that becomes a theme for a course. I mean, think about this. You're teaching a second half of American history, and it's all about incarceration.
I mean, you
can't make this stuff up.
Wrong. I'm in the wrong classroom.
Yeah.
So would you say that we're seeing basic ideas of good and evil redefined so that we've got a struggle between the powerless, those are good, and the powerful, those are bad, and colorblindness with race, colorblindness is replaced by race obsession?
These syllabis reflected obsession on racism and white supremacy, which is often a theme in these courses, but also sexual identity. We were actually surprised by how much sexual identity, not gender, but specifically sexual identity, was introduced. So we have some of the syllabi had a couple weeks on sexual identity and the oppression of gays, and even talking about transgender. So you see discussions of transgender in the 1920s.
Wow.
We were surprised by the themes, the negative themes that were found in these syllabi. And I've been teaching quite a while, so, and others that did the research have been as well. And we were surprised. We expected most professors to be pretty lazy and not update their syllabi to talk about sexual identity and the oppression of transgendered people.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, we're out of time, Dr. Critchlow. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. And God bless you.
Thanks.
Do good work.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll talk again, Lord willing.
How is authority structured in the Catholic Church? Christ is the source of all authority in the Church. The Lord made St. Peter the rock of his church, the shepherd of the whole flock. The Pope, Bishop of Rome, and Peter's successor is the perpetual and visible source and foundation of the unity both of the bishops and the whole company of the faithful, according to the Catholic Catechism. Thus, his successor, the Pope and Vicar of Christ on earth, has full, supreme, and universal power, which he can always exercise unhindered. The College of Bishops has no power unless linked to the Roman Pontiff. When united to the Pope as its head, the College has supreme and full authority over the universal Church. But that power cannot be exercised without the agreement of the Roman Pontiff. The College of Bishops exercises power over the Church in an ecumenical council, but the Catechism reminds us there is never an ecumenical council which is not confirmed or at least recognized as such by the Pope. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
Two of the hardest words to say in the English language. I'm sorry. I'll ask couples, when was the last time you said I'm sorry? I think it was our wedding rehearsal dinner. I spilled some coffee on her lap. I said, hey, sorry about that. Why is I'm sorry so hard to say? What does it mean to you? Are you saying you're a failure? Are you saying I'm wrong? Are you saying, if I say I'm sorry, I'm admitting it's all my fault? I'm sorry are two of the softest words in a relationship in the English language. I'm sorry, very hard to say, very easy on relationships.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart-friendly, ride-your-bike-everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort-style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Do you have an insurance plan that pays for everything? Even things you don't believe in? There are options. You can join Solidarity HealthShare, a faith-based health-sharing community. Plus, Solidarity HealthShare can save you money with prices starting as low as $384 a month for families.
Call to see how much you can save. 844-398-9399. That's 844-398-9399.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. I mean, it's a natural question. Why should I trust the Gospels, right? I mean, these are ancient documents, ancient stories, far removed from us by distance and culture. And at some time or other, any diligent reader of Scripture is going to begin asking some questions. Why can I trust these testimonies, these stories, these proclamations of good news? Well, my guest, Dr. Lydia McGrew, is author of Testimonies to the Truth, Why You Can Trust the Gospels. She's also, in fact, she's joined us once before on this program, defending the reliability of the Gospels and the Book of Acts in her book, Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts. And she is a widely published analytic philosopher, author, wife of philosopher and apologist Timothy McGrew. She received her doctorate in English from Vanderbilt University in 1995 and has published extensively in the theory of knowledge, specializing in formal epistemology and in its application to the evaluation of testimony and to the philosophy of religion. She defends the integrity of the Gospels. And Dr. McGrew, good to have you with me. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Al. It's great to be here.
What I love about the work that you do is you're not looking from necessarily outside the Gospels to verify what's in the Gospels. You actually give a close reading to the Gospels and find things there that point these are believable stories. Why did you go that route?
Well, I wanted to revive some older views of the Gospels from even the 19th century. My husband drew my attention to this some years ago, and that got me started with Hidden in Plain View, where what they did was they tried to take what we might call common sense and apply that here. What would we expect to find if these really did come from people who were in the know, who were friends with Jesus, and who really knew what they were talking about? And then the interesting thing is, when we go, we actually find that. So in a sense, we're using things from outside, but they're not these highly critical tools where we're starting by assuming that they're not true and maybe getting a few little grains of truth out of them. Instead, we're taking for a real test drive the theory that they are coming from people who really know what they're talking about and applying that common sense to them, and it's a very fruitful method.
Well, tell us, what is the lesson of your first chapter, Location, Location, Location?
Right. Well, that's something that I didn't do in Hidden in Plain View. These are what are sometimes called external confirmations. And here they come from the locations that are mentioned in the Gospels, things like geography or rulers and that kind of thing. And what you discover is that even in these teeny little details, like the fact that Cana is in the hills and Capernaum is down actually somewhat below sea level, and John just casually says they went down from Cana to Capernaum, you know, you find them talking like they really know those places.
Yeah. Do obscure place names pop up?
They do. I mean, Cana itself is very obscure. It's something that, you know, if John was writing in Ephesus, I doubt that his readers there were going, oh, yeah, I know Cana. You know, he's mentioning this little tiny city, you know, like someone here in Michigan mentioning, I don't know, Climax, Michigan or something that somebody outside Michigan might never have heard of.
Yeah. Do they get? Let's take Luke for instance. Does he get the rulers right that he refers to?
He does, and it's particularly astonishing when he refers to rulers that maybe our scholars at first thought didn't exist, and then in one case they learned that he did. So there was this guy named Lysanias, and Luke mentions him in the beginning verses of Luke 3. Well, the only Lysanias that we had heard of for a long time had died long before the time of Christ, you know, decades before, and they thought, Luke just made a mistake. And then there was an archaeological discovery of this inscription that indicated that there was another Lysanias that actually lived during the time of John the Baptist and the time of Jesus. He could have even been the other guy's son. You know, so Luke got it right after all.
Wow. What about names like Pilate, Herod Antipas, and Herod's brother Philip? Do we have references outside the text to those names?
We do. In Josephus, for one, you know, the Jewish historian. And the interesting thing there is that you really see Luke's historical intention, where he's mentioning both more famous and less famous rulers, all just to pinpoint the year when he says the word of the Lord came to John, the son of Zechariah, that would be John the Baptist, in the wilderness. It's like boom, 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 boom. When all these people were reigning, that's when John the Baptist started his ministry. So there's no question of Luke trying to write something mythical or legendary. He is really locating it precisely in history.
You know, in the prologue to his gospel, he seems to make a big deal about checking all these things out with the eyewitnesses and those who are ministers of the word. And I assume we ought to take him at face value there, right?
I think we should, and the great thing is that we don't even have to just kind of be naive and go, oh, well, you know, if he says he's telling us the truth, I guess he must be, but we can say, well, does it look like he's telling us the truth?
Yeah, certainly.
And when we look, it turns out that it does look exactly like that.
Yeah. You talk about undesigned coincidences, and that was also in your earlier book. But what is an undesigned coincidence?
It's an incidental fitting together of details that points to the truth of both stories, even when they come from different sources or different people. I like to give a made-up example. If you had two people who said that they saw a bank robbery, and one of them said, hey, the guy tripped when he was running away, and then the other person claiming to be a witness said, so I looked at him and his shoe was untied. Those two stories would fit together even though they're different people telling these different things. But yeah, why did he trip? Because his shoe was untied. So they're not trying to make their stories fit together. They're just both telling the truth, and that's why their stories fit together.
So do we see that kind of fitting together between the Gospels and John's Gospel, which is, you know, not one of the synoptic Gospels?
Yeah, that's what's really interesting, is that they don't even always tell the same stories, and yet they can fit together even in different stories. So I'll give an example. This one wasn't in my earlier books. This new example in this book. In the Synoptic Gospels, we have the story of Bartimaeus and his friend, the two blind men who are healed by Jesus in Jericho. And it says they heard a loud noise of all the crowd coming, and they said, what's happening? And the people said, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. They immediately begin to cry out, Son of David, have mercy on us and help us. And they come to Jesus, and he asks what they want. They say that we may receive our sight. Now, what you might not notice is that in the Synoptic Gospels, we haven't seen any account of a miracle performed that far south near Jericho in the Synoptics. They focus on Jesus' ministry up north in Galilee. So how did they know to where they got so excited right away? Well, you go over to John's Gospel. He doesn't have that story about those blind men, but he has a story about a different blind man about 6 months before that who was born blind that Jesus healed right in Jerusalem, which is closer to Jericho. And also he raised Lazarus from the dead. Those stories were really exciting to people in that vicinity. Very plausibly, that's how those two blind beggars in Jericho thought to themselves, hey, maybe this guy can help us. So those are totally different stories, and yet the one helps to explain the other.
Yeah. Is there any particular gospel writer that kind of has more undesigned coincidences than others?
I find that John, if you just count them up, probably has the most. And my theory about the reason for that is that he tells so much unique material. So in a sense, I say the more John tells us, the more he gets confirmed, which is not what critical scholars think. They want to say just the opposite, yeah. You know, that he's making up more stuff. But actually, we find that precisely because he's saying, telling different things, then he fits in these subtle ways with the synoptics. But they do all have them, and in different directions.
I'm just curious from the standpoint of academic scholarship on this. Is there a new respect for this kind of close reading?
It really depends on who you ask.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I would say among the sort of self-consciously critical scholars, take someone like Bart Ehrman, who's a skeptical scholar.
Right.
No, he doesn't have any new respect at all.
Right.
But I'd like to say that within the Christian community, I'm hoping I'm doing my small part along with other scholars. Like there's a British scholar named Peter J. Williams who has a book called Can We Trust the Gospels? You know, doing some similar things.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'd like to say we're giving people a stiffer backbone to say, no, you know, you don't have to make concessions. You actually can defend these things as honest reportage.
Yeah. How significant is the debates about dating the Gospels?
In some ways, dating estimates have gotten less extreme to where, you know, you won't really find scholars putting John way in the second century whatever. But I don't think we always need to nail the dating down precisely. And I think John's a good example. If it was in fact written by a disciple of Jesus who had an excellent memory, then if he's writing before the fall of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, or if he's writing in his old age in A.D. 85. As long as we can tell that he really is an eyewitness and he really remembers things well, it's more the authorship that matters than the exact dating.
Gotcha. Dr. Lydia McGrew, my guest.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Support for this Ave Maria Radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Most parents would like to raise generous kids, but where do you start? Well, authentic generosity doesn't start with serving strangers. It starts with looking for little ways families can make each other's lives easier at home. Start a new habit in your family. Make it a rule that everyone should look for one way to leave a room better than they found it. It doesn't matter who left the coat off the hook or who left the toy on the floor. If you see it, deal with it. The important point is, good teams don't bicker about whose job something is, because everybody on the team is just committed to giving their all to get the job done. Practicing generous service at home is one of the most important things Catholic families can do. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John 14. This is Jesus in the upper room with the disciples before he's going out to his sacrifice of himself for our salvation. And Philip says to the Lord, "Show us the Father, and we'll be satisfied." Jesus looks at Philip and says, "Philip, have I been with you all this time? Don't you understand? When you see me, you're looking at the Father." In fact, only two people throughout human history have given rise to the question, not who is he, but what is he? The two people are Buddha and Jesus. Buddha's answer was, don't come to me, don't look to me, look to my doctrine, look to what I teach. Jesus' answer was, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Jesus is explicitly claiming to be God.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Lydia McGrew, author most recently of Testimonies to the Truth, Why You Can Trust the Gospels. And again, she does a very close reading of the gospel texts and points to details that don't make sense if the stories were simply inventions. You mentioned unnecessary details, for instance, Dr. McGrew. What do you mean by unnecessary details?
Well, what I mean is that they are not essential to the narrative, and that gives the narrative a sound like as if you were talking to, let's say, a Gulf War veteran who's telling you about his experiences, that kind of natural oral history. We humans just tend to mention unnecessary things. So an example in the Gospel of Mark would be when Jesus is asleep in the boat and there's a storm and the disciples are afraid, it says he was sleeping on a pillow. Now that pillow does not, it doesn't feature, you know, that cushion doesn't have any other role, and I don't think it has some, you know, symbolic value or anything. He's just sleeping on a pillow. Yeah. And that's what Peter remembered and probably told Mark.
You also point to the story of the raising of Jairus' daughter. Tell us about that.
Well, in the raising of Jairus' daughter, we have these details where, for example, there are flute players. They're there in the book of Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they must have showed up, you know, hoping for a gig or something, because, you know, we actually find in the Talmud that it says to have, you know, flute players at a funeral to show that you, you know, esteemed the person or whatever. So these little things, again, they fit with what we know of the culture at the time, and yet they're not essential to the story, rather the kind of things these eyewitnesses remembered. And I want to notice here, as a person with a doctorate in English literature, the ultra-realistic novel that we are so familiar with was not going to be invented for hundreds and hundreds of years. They had fiction, but it wasn't like our fiction where every little detail is described or anything like that. The Gospels authors would have had to invent a non-existent genre that then fell back off the map for over 1,000 years thereafter. And the better and simpler explanation is that they really got this information from eyewitnesses or were themselves eyewitnesses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You also referred to unexplained allusions. What are they?
Yeah, that's a new argument in this book, not in Hidden in Plain View. So if I were telling somebody about a car accident and I said, I was on my way to a KSO concert and this guy rear-ended me, and I just move on and tell about, you know, how rude the guy was who rear-ended me or whatever, and I'm not reflecting on the fact, oh, this person lives in Colorado and he doesn't know what a KSO stands for, Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so busy telling my story that I just get on. I don't stop to explain that. And we find that same mark of unconscious witness testimony, where they have their eye on their audience at every moment. Like in a literary production, they're just trying to tell what happened. So an example in John, he says that the disciples of John the Baptist were having a argument with someone about purification, and they came to John the Baptist, and from then on all we get is they complain about Jesus making more followers than John the Baptist, and John the Baptist says he must increase, I must decrease. We literally never get back to what that dispute was about specifically. Was it a follower of Jesus? What were they arguing about? Purification? Nothing. It just gets dropped. That's because John the evangelist knows that was really how that argument got started and really why they came to John the Baptist. But then he wants to get on to John saying, he must increase, I must decrease, so he drops the dispute. Mm-hmm. That's an example of an unexplained allusion.
Yes. And you mentioned this is a new category that you've discovered. What about, you write about the Sons of Thunder. James and John. I always thought that was a funny designation. Do we have any further? Do we have any explanation of this nickname?
Not explicitly. I mean, people have theorized that it might have been, you know, related to when they called upon, they asked Jesus if they should call fire down from heaven. Now, sometimes an unexplained allusion is what I call one half of an undesigned coincidence. It's like unexplained in that document, and then you go somewhere else in another document, you find an explanation. But we don't know. It could have just been that they were rowdy. I mean, these were all fairly young men. You know, I think I've known some teenage boys that could have been called Sons of Thunder.
Yes.
You know, and so all Mark is interested in is just telling you that that was their nickname, and then he just moves on. He doesn't pause like you might expect in a literary production to say, and the story behind that, blah, 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 blah. He's just listing Jesus' disciples and giving their nickname when he happens to know it.
Can we assume that that nickname was something that would have been apparent to the original audience?
Not even necessarily. I mean, maybe some members of them knew. If they were in a dialogue situation, they could have said, excuse me, Peter, you know, why, if it's an oral, you know, why were they called that, you know? But I think the more interesting thing is that the author himself doesn't necessarily mind whether his audience knows the explanation, because he's going somewhere else. In this case, with Mark, he's listing the rest of the apostles, you know, or with John, he's wanting to tell you what John the Baptist said about Jesus and how humble John the Baptist was. And so that shows they're not polishing it. So even if the original audience didn't know, they're not in there going, oh, I got to edit that out. This audience isn't going to know what I'm talking about.
Right.
They're just telling it as it occurs to them.
That's right. That's right. You also refer to unexpected harmonies. Give me an example or two. Or what is it? What are they, first of all?
Yeah, well, you know, critical scholars hate harmonization. When you have an apparent or alleged contradiction, and then you're like, oh, yeah, you know, actually, that can work. That's not necessarily a contradiction. But in real life, that's often true, you know, where you'll say, oh, I don't think that could have really happened that way because it seems to contradict this other thing. Then it'll turn out it really did, and there's something you never thought of. So I do a lot in that chapter with Jesus' resurrection, the resurrection stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when in Luke, he reports Jesus as saying, you know, don't leave Jerusalem, but wait for the coming of the Holy Ghost. Well, you know, it's like in Matthew, it mentions that they went to Galilee. So, of course, skeptics will bring that up. They'll go, hey, did they disobey him? You know, why did they go to Galilee? What does it mean? Don't leave Jerusalem. But then when you read John, John kind of brings together Matthew and Luke, although he doesn't, you know, say he's doing that, obviously. I don't think he was trying to do that. But you have Jesus appearing to them in Jerusalem at first, then they go up to Galilee, and they see Jesus there. Then we learn in the first chapter of Acts that they were back down near the Mount of Olives. So they traveled. He was with them, as Acts tells us, for 40 days. So there was plenty of time to walk back and forth. That's an unexpected harmony that you can actually fit it all together when you get up high and you get the big picture.
You also have a chapter on unified personalities, and your first point is that real people are hard to fake.
They really, really are. You know, if you ever binge watch television show, you'll go, hey, you know, if that guy is really so kind and sensitive and serious, you know, why does he do this other insensitive thing over here in this other show or whatever? And even with all the resources we have now for being careful like that, you still get variations among writers of different episodes. But in the Gospels, what we find are several very striking personalities across different stories, different Gospels, and yet it's clearly the same guy. Like Peter is a really good example.
Yeah,
of this.
Explain that, because he is a character that's given a lot of attention.
He is. He's, you know, probably the most prominent disciple. So an example I like to give is that Peter likes to argue. And yet he likes to argue because he loves Jesus. So it's this very striking characteristic of what I think of as loving argumentativeness. So in the synoptics, Jesus says, I'm going to be crucified. I'm going to die. And Peter pulls him aside and he says, no, Lord, you got it wrong. You're not going to die. That would be terrible. Of course, Lord, you're not going to die. And Jesus is like, get thee behind me. Say, you know, he really rebukes him. But even though Peter needs, in a sense, to be rebuked, why does he say that? Because he loves Jesus so much. He can't bear the thought of him dying. Well, now we go over to John, and Jesus wants to wash his feet. And Peter goes, no, you're never going to wash my feet, right?
That's
because
right.
He's offended because it was such a lowly, only slaves wash people's feet. You know, and Peter can't stand that thought. Well, again, it's because he loves Jesus so much, but it's a completely different story. You know, or when Jesus says, you're all going to forsake me tonight. And Peter says, not me. You know, he said, I'll never forsake you, Lord. And there's this very touching moment in John where Jesus says, you will follow me, but you can't follow me now. And Peter says, why can't I follow you now? I'll die for you. And, you know, even though we know he didn't stick to that, he did deny him later, again, there's that loving argumentativeness, that tenderness of heart. And I think that's why Peter was able to be restored after Jesus' resurrection.
Yeah. And it's amazing. That's kind of an extravagant personality, warm-hearted, though. Peter's walking on the water story expresses this as well. This consistency, what do critical scholars do with this kind of consistency?
You know, I hardly ever see them talking about it, but the closest you can get, there's a sort of assumption that we already know that these things are at least partially fiction. And so then they can attribute pretty much any degree of brilliance and creativity and in making up fiction to the authors because they've sort of already made up their minds that it's fiction to the point that it never occurs to them how implausible this is, that they would tell such completely different stories and yet portray the same person in such a consistent but varying way. They're not really interested in seeing that there because they think they already know they're made up.
Yeah. So what do they do then with kind of the explicit testimony, Luke's prologue, which makes it clear he's not doing fiction here, and also in John where he says eyewitness, and then First John.
And First
what do they make
Peter,
of that?
Where we didn't follow cleverly designed fables.
Yes.
You know, it's an astonishing point that doesn't bother them more. It's a sort of an assumption of an agenda, like almost as if these are, in a sense, hoaxes. You know, they're trying to present themselves as true, but they're not really true.
Yeah.
Another possibility is that, well, everybody just knew that that was just the way you talked. You know, you talked like you were making a real story, but not really.
Okay. Dr. McGrew, thank you again. Wonderful talking with you.
It's been great, Al. Thank you so much.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization. Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The Encounter Conference, June 26th through the 28th at the New Glass City Center in Toledo, Ohio. 15 powerful speakers.
It is the encounter with the Holy Spirit that makes Jesus come alive and gives us the courage and the wisdom to go forth and to even risk our own lives.
Everyone pretty much says the miracles that Jesus did are real. The miracles that the early church did are real.
As often as the popes are talking about the new evangelization, they're also saying we need to pray for a new Pentecost. We need to return to the upper room. Encounter represents the church returning to the upper room. As we're coming boldly before God and asking him to renew that Pentecostal fire for the strength, the gifts, and the wisdom to be able to preach Jesus to a lost and broken world, so that we can become fully alive in Him, so that the world may come to believe that Jesus is the one whom God sent.
Register today at EncounterConference.org. That's EncounterConference.org. We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Thanks for being with us over that last 2 hours. Go to AveMariaRadio.net. You can follow up on the conversations we had. We'll have a Lydia McGrew's book available discussing the reliability of the Gospels. You can take a look at that study that Dr. Donald Critchlow did examining how American history is being taught to American students. Also, we'll have from the first hour our conversation with Marianne Glendon on her great book, Working in the Court of Three Popes, and the work she has done in various relations with the Vatican. And also our conversation with Father John Ricardo is available. All of that at AveMariaRadio.net. And always remember that if you have the TuneIn app, you can listen to EWTN Radio live wherever you have access to your smartphone. Just go to TuneIn and search for EWTN. We're going off the air. Catholic Answers Live is ready to take your calls. And we'll see you tomorrow with another edition of Cresta in the Afternoon. Have a great evening and God bless.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.